Well, we're just a few minutes away from Bernie Sanders here at Dominican University of California, another Institute for Leadership Studies lecture. December 2nd, 2016. The great man, Senator Bernie Sanders, coming up in just a few minutes right here on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. Please stay with us. Well, the moment has arrived, everyone. Senator Bernie Sanders is here in the house. Angelico Hall, Dominican University of California. You're listening to Penguin Radio, another worldwide broadcast. I'm your host, Stuart Horn. For tonight, Institute for Leadership Studies. And Senator Sanders, good enough to stop by Penguin Radio and give me a handshake on his way to the stage here at Angelico Hall. Angelico seats 850, and the people have been here for a couple of hours, lined up around the block. Everybody's really excited, and we're happy that you're here with us, right here on Penguin Radio.
Good evening. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Mary Marcy, and I have the privilege of being the president of Dominican University of California. Welcome to an extraordinary evening in a remarkable lecture series. We have hosted this leadership lecture series for a number of years, and over that time we have had over 100 renowned authors in partnership with Book Passage, Marin and San Francisco's own independent bookstore. Thank you to Book Passage. This series is a program of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies, which offers education and training for students and professionals to become strong, effective leaders. And there is no time more than today that we need strong, effective leaders. The series is possible through the generosity of those who believe that dialogue, exposure to ideas, and civic discussion are central to our community and essential to our future. And for 6 years, we have been fortunate to have the support of Private Ocean Wealth Management as a lead sponsor of our leadership lecture series. Private Ocean is one of the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin, and with their support, we have been able to strengthen and sustain this amazing community engagement experience. Redwood Credit Union is also sponsoring this evening's festivities. Founded in 1950, Redwood Credit Union is our local community credit union, a financial cooperative focused on people, not profits. So please join me in thanking both of our sponsors who helped make these forums a reality. I'm also very pleased to introduce a special guest this evening. I want to recognize Jane Sanders, Senator Sanders' wife, who's in the hall this evening. Now, we have to behave, and the stakes are high, because Jane Sanders herself has a doctorate in leadership and policy studies, and she knows about leadership and lecture series. Welcome to Marin County. We're very happy to have you here. It's a poignant time to welcome Senator Sanders to Dominican. We're in a community that, like much of the country, has been struggling to come to terms with an election of unprecedented vitriol and uncertain implications. And we arrive in this position after a campaign in which many in our community were deeply invested and deeply engaged. For Dominican, this involvement took the shape of a national student movement that is still changing the landscape of millennial political engagement. Dominican worked as a partner with the U.S. Commission on Presidential Debates to create an initiative called College Debate 16. We challenged students from colleges across the nation to work together to identify the top issues that mattered to this generation. That's all we did. We gave them a platform, and they ran with it. They engaged with their peers on campus and via social media. They examined policies, became informed, learned from each other, focused on issues, not party politics. They focused on mutual respect, not disdain for opposing views. And their reach was incredible. Through this Dominican-led initiative, College Debate 16 reached over 1.78 million people through social media and realized over 64 million media imprints. In a campaign where much was dispiriting, this was inspiring. Many of these students are on the stage right now. Many of them were energized to engage in civic action because of Senator Bernie Sanders. In a recent New York Times opinion article, Senator Sanders reminded us that when his presidential campaign came to an end, the political movement would continue. He wrote, "When we stand together and don't let demagogues divide us by race, by gender, or national origin, there is nothing we cannot accomplish. We must go forward, not backward." Unity, understanding, and respect are words that resonate with many here tonight, especially these students who join us on stage, who served as your ushers, who are in the audience, and a whole bunch of them who are on the wait list to try and get in this evening. One of those students now joins me to introduce Senator Sanders. Tigis Wirku was one of our College Debate 2016 delegates and very much earned the privilege to introduce Senator Sanders. Tigis?
Hello, everyone. When I was a sophomore, I interned with the National Council on U.S. and Arab Relations, where I conducted research on the conflict in Syria. The following year, I studied in France, and in my spare time, I traveled. One of the most memorable places I went was Istanbul, Turkey. This experience opened my eyes to other cultures, people, and views. So when I was elected to become a college delegate, I jumped at the opportunity. Despite our varied backgrounds, we were able to find common ground. We were able to listen to other views and understand, accept, and even appreciate our differences. After all, we all want the same thing, a safe and secure future. Perhaps this is why Senator Sanders resonates so deeply with our generation. In our revolution, the senator talks about the need to support a new generation of progressive leaders, empower millions to fight for progressive change, and elevate the political consciousness. Together, he says, we'll reclaim the democracy for the working people of our country by harnessing the transformative energy of the political revolution. Becoming informed was a heart of our College Debate 2016 initiative. Senator Sanders has an important message for us. I am eager to hear more. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, this is a wonderful turnout, and I thank all of you for coming, and I thank Dominican University for hosting the event, and President Marcy, thank you for your generous introduction. And Tigis, thank you very much, not only for your introduction, but for the very, very important work you and your fellow students are doing. I want to talk about the book, because the book is, I think, relevant to where we are today. But before I get to the book, I think there are probably one or two other things on your minds. Could be wrong, but I think maybe. So let me just go over my views on what's happened in the last 3 weeks or so. Number one, it is important to remember that Donald Trump did not get the most votes in this election. In fact, Hillary Clinton will end up with some 2.5 million more votes than he did. And what's important about that is not only raising concerns about the Electoral College and how somebody who loses the popular vote by 2.5 million votes is the person who gets inaugurated. What is maybe even more important, though, is to understand that Mr. Trump does not have a mandate. And our job every day of the week is to remind him of that. And I'll get into this a little bit later, and I guess we have some questions that you have asked, but I look at this election is not primarily a victory for Mr. Trump, who wins the election as the most unpopular candidate in perhaps the history of our entire country. I see this not simply as a victory for him, but as a loss for the Democratic Party. And why the Democratic Party allowed that to happen, and why the Democratic Party has lost the United States Senate, the U.S. House of Representatives, 2/3 of the governor's chairs in this country, and 900 legislative seats and state houses all across the country over the last 8 years, is a subject that needs a lot of discussion. I was appointed a couple of weeks ago as part of the Democratic leadership. My job is to do outreach, so I'm here tonight to outreach you. I don't think that's the proper grammar. I don't outreach people, but I'm here to get you involved in the political process, and we can talk about that in a moment. The other point that I want to make that I think it's important for everybody here to remember is that on every major issue facing this country, it turns out that poll after poll indicates that the vast majority of the people in our country agree with a progressive agenda. Let me just go through that. If you do a poll today and you say to people, should we raise the minimum wage, which is now a starvation level of $7.25 an hour at the federal level? Should we raise the federal minimum wage to a living wage? My view is that is $15 an hour. You know what? Most people say yes. Nobody can make it on $7.25 or $9 an hour or $10 an hour. If you go out and you ask the American people, should women receive pay equity? Should there be equal pay for equal work? Overwhelming majority of the American people say yes. If you ask the American people, should we make, in a very significant way, college in America more affordable so that every one of our people, regardless of his or her income, is able to go to college and not leave school deeply in debt? Again, overwhelmingly, the American people say yes. Now, the economy today is absolutely a lot better than it was 8 years ago when President Obama first came in. But unemployment, especially in various parts of the country, remain much too high. And if you ask the American people, should we create millions of good-paying jobs by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, our roads and bridges and water systems and rail system, wastewater plants, etc., the American people will say yes. If you ask the American people, Republicans and Democrats, whether it is acceptable that billionaires like Mr. Trump pay zero in federal income tax, they will say no, that the wealthy and large corporations must begin paying their fair share of taxes. Right now, in our country, certainly an issue that is going to surface, I suspect, that within the first year of Mr. Trump's administration, right now in America and in California, there are a lot of undocumented people. Nationally, about 11 million undocumented people. The American people believe that we should pass comprehensive immigration reform and a path toward citizenship. That's what the American people believe. Right now in America, we have about 2.2 million people in jail at this moment. Over 2 million people in jail. We are spending $80 billion a year at the local, state, and federal level, locking up fellow Americans. The American people and a lot of conservatives have been speaking out on this issue, understand that it is absurd that we are spending so much money to lock up so many people, that we have more people in jail than any other country on earth. China, 4 times our size, we have more people in jail than China does. And what the American people understand is that it makes a lot more sense to invest in jobs and education rather than jails and incarceration. The American people, and again, this is not just what I believe, what many of you believe, but the point that I'm making here is this is what the American people believe. And the American people understand that we have a corrupt campaign finance system. And it is more corrupt than you know, because it is not just that the Koch brothers and other billionaires can spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to buy elections. It's not just that the pharmaceutical industry can spend $131 million right here in California to defeat Proposition 61. But what ends up happening is you have the good guys, so to speak, spending an unbelievable amount of time trying to raise money in order to get their ads on television in order to respond. So you got a Congress that, instead of dealing with the real issues impacting the American people, everybody is frantically out raising money. And one of the things that we did in our campaign, and I write about it in the book, is we did a fundraiser here in Marin County many, many years ago. Anybody here was there? I thank you. But this campaign, we said, I'm not going to waste my time doing that. I am not going to sit around with 20 wealthy people trying to raise money. We're going to do rallies with tens of thousands of people. And we ended up being able in our campaign to raise several hundred million dollars, a lot of money, through 2.8 million individual Americans who made contributions averaging $27 apiece. And what the American people do understand, whether they are Republican and conservative, a Democrat, progressive, whatever, is that democracy does not mean billionaires being able to buy elections. That's not democracy. And there's a lot of concern about that. So my point is, number one, Hillary Clinton got 2.5 million more votes than Donald Trump. Point number two, virtually every major issue facing our country, the American people support a progressive agenda. There are areas where they don't. The country is divided on issues like a woman's right to choose. I think most Americans do not want to see Roe v. Wade ended, but there are many Americans who do want to restrict a woman's right. My view is a woman does have a right to control her own body, and that's not a... There are differences of opinion on gay rights, but I will tell you that on that issue, those of us who believe in gay rights, who believe in gay marriage, we are winning this thing overwhelmingly because it is very much a generational issue. I remember in my own state, I got out to high schools a whole lot, and a couple of years ago, I was up in one of the more conservative parts of the state, and I asked the kids, I said, well, Hamid, raise your hand if you think, and Vermont has been a leader in the country on gay marriage, but this is a conservative part of the state. And I said, raise your hand if you think, if you support gay marriage. And there was almost a shrug of the shoulders, even in this conservative part of the state, is what is the big deal? What are you talking about? So it is a general, you know, meanwhile, their grandparents may have a very different point of view. But, you know, I think most people perceive that we have made a lot of progress in terms of gay rights. Guns, differences of opinion, clearly. You know, there are some people who absolutely believe that it is their constitutional right to have a nuclear launcher in their backyard. But even on that issue, even on that issue. If you ask people, do you think that there should be a strict background check for people who purchase guns? Overwhelmingly, gun owners and non-gun owners believe that there should be. So, two important points. Clinton won the election, popular vote, 2.5 million. Number two, on virtually all of the important issues facing the country, the American people support a progressive agenda. Now, despite all of that, and we can talk about the reasons why, despite all of that, Mr. Trump will be inaugurated, it's important to try to determine how we go forward as Mr. Trump becomes president. And I think there are a few points I want to make in that regard. In politics, you do compromise. That's what politics is about. But I think, especially with Mr. Trump coming into office, there are some areas, very deep areas, areas that go to the soul of what our country is about, that there cannot be any compromise. One of those areas, I think, is to tell Mr. Trump that this country has struggled for too many hundreds of years to fight against discrimination against Native Americans, slavery, denying African Americans the right to vote, denying women the right to vote, discrimination against the gay community, discrimination against Catholics, against Italians, against the Irish, against the Jews. Just, we have gone through it all. And what we can say with some pride, not to deny that racism and sexism and homophobia do not exist, of course they exist. But on the other hand, what we can say with some pride is this country has come a long, long way in becoming a less discriminatory society. And there has never been a generation in American history that is less racist, less sexist, less homophobic than the young generation of today. And we should be very proud of that. Now, I think most of you know that before he became a candidate for president, Mr. Trump was a leader of the so-called Bertha Movement. And let me be very clear in telling you that the Bertha Movement was nothing less than a racist effort to undermine the legitimacy of the first African-American president in our history. So this was not an attempt to disagree with Obama. That is more than permissible. Everyone has the right to disagree with anyone they want. But this was really to say, hey, this black guy who's president, you know, he really should not be president because he really, really wasn't born in America. You know, a total lie. And I mean, the absurdity is I ran for president. I am the son of an immigrant. I'm a first-generation American. Nobody ever asked me for my birth certificate. Maybe it has something to do with the color of my skin. I don't know. All right, but in my view, on this issue, as a nation that has struggled painfully for generations, for centuries, a nation that has seen wonderful and brave people die in the struggle, go to jail in the struggle, get lynched, get beaten in the fight against racism and sexism, and homophobia, and all forms of discrimination. Our message to Mr. Trump must be, we are not going backward, we are going forward. End of discussion on that issue. And there's another issue where, you know, we can't compromise. Again, not because compromise is a bad thing, but sometimes you just can't. Mr. Trump ran his campaign for president by telling the American people that after years and years of exhaustive study on the issue, he has concluded that climate change is a hoax. Well, again, our message to Mr. Trump is not only is climate change not a hoax, it is far and away the most serious environmental crisis that our planet faces. Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity. It is already causing devastating problems in our country and around the world. And what the scientists are telling us, and I am a member of the U.S. Senate Committee on the Environment, chaired, by the way, by somebody we are going to miss a whole lot, and that is U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, good friend. And what Barbara and I will tell you is that we have talked to scientists all over the world, and the debate really is over. And what the scientists are telling us is that if we do not get our act together, which means in a very bold and aggressive way, transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energies, if we don't do that, what we will be seeing in the years to come is more drought, more floods, more extreme weather disturbances, more acidification of the ocean, more rising sea levels, and more international conflict as people around the world fight over dwindling natural resources like water and land to grow their crops. So there cannot be a compromise on this issue, because as custodians of the planet Earth, our only home, we have a moral responsibility to leave that home, this planet, to our children and grandchildren in a way that is healthy and habitable. And we cannot compromise on that issue as well. And there's another issue where there cannot be compromise. The other day, Mr. Trump sent out a tweet, and it appears that we're going to be governed by tweets. New form of government. 140 characters or less, and there we go. And Mr. Tweet. Mr. Trump made a very profound statement, almost as brilliant as his thoughts on climate change. And this particular statement was that he would have won the popular vote if millions of Americans had not voted illegally. Now, there is nobody who believes that. Republicans don't believe that. Nobody believes it. I mean, it's just not based in any fact world, which is something else. And this is not a joke that we're going to have to come used to, because increasingly, these guys are not living in factual world. It does not really matter. If people believe it, it becomes a fact, no matter how absurd it is. But the point about, in my view, about Trump's statement was it really was a message going out to Republican leaders all over the country. And that is that they have got to intensify their efforts in voter suppression. Because if you honestly believed, you know, if millions of people in this country voted illegally, that would be a huge problem, no question about it, and would have to be dealt with really severely. Voter fraud is a major crime. People who do that should be severely punished. The good news is that in America, we have virtually no voter fraud. That's just a fact. We don't, okay? And when Trump says that millions of people are voting illegally, what he is really saying is let us be very aggressive in making sure that immigrants who are legal in this country, who have the right to vote, poor people, African Americans, older people, younger people, we're going to make it as hard as we can for them to participate in the political process. And there are pretty easy ways to do it, not very difficult. If you come up with expensive ID cards that you need, you know, not everybody owns a car, not everybody has a government ID. If you make it difficult for people to access a location to get a government ID, if you kind of make it uncomfortable for people to vote, if you're going to have people standing around the polling place questioning people, et cetera, you can suppress the vote. And that is what is going on right now all over this country. And I think Trump's message is that they want to intensify that effort. Second point, in terms of democracy, not only do they want to suppress the vote, here's what else they want to do. I happen to believe that Citizens United is the worst Supreme Court decision in the modern history of America. My Republican colleagues in the Senate and the House, and the Koch brothers and other billionaires, what they think is that Citizens United did not go far enough. What Citizens United says in practical terms is that if you are a billionaire like the Koch brothers, or Sheldon Adelson, or somebody else, you can now spend on the Citizens United as much money as you want in a variety of political ways, putting ads on TV and the radio and doing all kinds of stuff. What you cannot do is coordinate your activities with the candidate. These have to be what is called independent expenditures. So when you turn on television and you get flooded by 30-second ads, they're paid for by Citizens for this or Citizens for that, which are just phony groups that are front groups for one billionaire group or another. Now, what these guys want to do is go further. They don't want to just have to be able to do independent expenditures. They want to be able to contribute directly to the candidate, have control over the entire campaign. In practical terms, what that means, somebody wants to run in an expensive state like the state of California. It costs a lot of money to run here. What the Koch brothers will be able to do if these guys get their way and eliminate all forms of campaign finance regulation, get rid of them all. What it will mean is the Koch brothers can go up to you and say, we're giving you a check for $300 million to run for the Senate. There's your campaign manager. There's your speechwriter. We own you. You work for me. Here is your check. You are accountable to me and me alone. So if you add those two factors together, voter suppression and doing away with all forms of campaign finance regulation, we are moving very rapidly to the undermining of American democracy. And this is just an enormously important issue. Again, an issue that we cannot compromise on, because that is what the fabric of America is supposed to be. It's supposed to be you get a vote, and you get a vote, and you get a vote. One person, one vote. Not the denial of the right to vote for people because they might vote against me, and not billionaires buying elections. So I urge you to pay attention to that issue and join us in the fight against oligarchy in this country and for democracy. Now, as I said earlier, I don't believe, you know, some people think that everybody who voted for Donald Trump is a racist or a sexist or a homophobe. I don't believe that at all. Some people are, but I think most aren't. What I think goes on, has gone on, is that a lot of people in this country are hurting, and they're hurting a lot more than many other people understand. Now, you can watch television to, as we say in Vermont, to the cows come home. That means a long time, that's what it means. Takes a while for the cows to come home. They move very slowly. And you really do not see the reality of America on the television or the radio. And what Trump was able to do is he was able to say to the American people, look, I know that you're hurting. I know that your jobs have gone to China or gone to Mexico. I know that you're working longer hours for low wages. And I, Donald Trump, I'm going to take on the entire establishment. I'm going to take on the economic establishment. I'm going to take on the political establishment. I'm going to take on the media establishment. And I think a lot of people ended up kind of holding their noses and voting for Trump because they are in pain and they are hurting. And they don't quite know if he's going to be able to do it, and I don't think he will do it. I think he lies a lot, and I think all of the things, or much of what he said during the campaign, he has absolutely no intention of fulfilling. But be that as it may, a lot of people voted for him because of some of what he said as a quote-unquote anti-establishment candidate. Let me just briefly tell you, during the course of the campaign, Jane and I went to 48 states around this country. and we saw a whole lot. And I want to give you a glimpse of what we saw and why I think Trump was able to get the votes that he did in various parts of the region. We talked to single moms who are working, and they're making, in some cases, adequate wages, income, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. They are paying $10,000 or $15,000 of that income for childcare. All right. Now think about being a single mom making $40,000 a year and paying $10,000, $15,000 as you desperately search for quality, affordable childcare. A woman who works for me in Washington, D.C., where things are more expensive than most places in the country, she got her kid, a little girl, into a good quality childcare center. She paid $32,000 a year for that. She and her husband could afford it. Most people can't. So you start off right there. Having a baby in this country is already a punishment. I mean, I said, what a terrible thing that is. I mean, we should be joyous about having babies and seeing young people grow up beautifully. And yet if you're a working person and you got to go to work, and if you're a single mom or both, mom and a dad, you're making $100,000 a year. How are you supposed to pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in child? And that's, we talk to people who are in that boat. We talked about, you know, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, added a lot more people to the rolls of health insurance. But the truth is, today, 28 million people have no health insurance, and even more, including people in this room, have health insurance, but you are underinsured with high deductibles and high copayments. And there's some of them who are, all right? Now, what does that mean, again, in a practical sense? It means that if you get hit by a bus, okay, the insurance will kick in. But it means that if you are sick today and you have a high deductible, what does it mean? It means you're not going to go to the doctor. That's what it means. And if you talk to doctors, as I do, there's no doctor that I have talked to who has not told me that he or she has lost patients. They died. Because by the time they walked into the doctor's office, it was too late. And the doctor says, well, why didn't you come in a year ago when you first got your symptoms? And the patient says, well, you know, I didn't have any health insurance. I had a high deductible. And sometimes the situation has reached terminal stages, or else they end up in the hospital at great expense and great suffering. And millions of people are sitting out there today. Their health care costs are going up. Donald Trump says he has a magnificent plan. A great plan. He hasn't told us what it is yet, but no doubt it'll be just terrific after they throw 20 million people off of health insurance by trying to end the Affordable Care Act. But again, I want you here. One of the concerns that I have is that we live in what I call a siloized nation. You know what I mean by siloized? What I mean is your life experience is very different than somebody on the other side of town or the other side of this country. And many people just do not know what other people are experiencing, and the media does a horrific job in reporting that reality. One out of five Americans, you're a working person, all right? You're making $30,000, $40,000 a year. You're sick, you go to the doctor, doctor diagnoses your problem, writes out a prescription, okay? One out of five Americans cannot afford to fill that prescription because of the outrageously high prices that the drug companies charge us. How are you feeling now about the political establishment? How are you feeling about all the speeches the politicians give you when you got a prescription and you're sick and you can't even afford to fill that prescription? In California and in Vermont, all over this country, so I've talked to many senior citizens. Seniors cut their prescription pills in half because they cannot afford the medicine they need. If you are a worker, and I talk to those workers in California and I talk to them in Vermont, all over this country, you're making 10, 12 bucks an hour. You can do the arithmetic as well as I can. You don't make it on $12 an hour or $10 an hour for yourself. After the high cost of rent and everything else, you don't make it taking care of a car, putting gas in the car, registering the car, fixing the car. You don't make it. But yet we got millions of people working for $12, $10 an hour. In America today, we have millions of older workers. Again, this is not on television. And this is one of the real problems that we have, because the reality of American life is not widely seen. Right now, you got people in California and Vermont, 60 years of age. They work their whole life. They're going to retire maybe in 5 years. Half of those older workers, 55 years of age or older, have how much in the bank? Anyone want to guess? Zero. Half of older workers, 55 or older, looking toward retirement, have zero in the bank. Think for a minute. Be that older worker. You've worked your entire life, and now you're going to retire. You're going to get your Social Security, maybe something else. You got nothing in the bank. How's the political establishment? How all the speeches from the Democrats and all, we're for the working people, and the Republicans love everybody and all that stuff. How's it working for you? Not quite so well if you are an older worker. And maybe for some of those older workers, by the way, they once had jobs in a factory, and if they had a union, they were making good wages with good benefits. But because of disastrous trade agreements signed by Democrats and Republicans, millions of good-paying jobs went to China and went to Mexico. And many of those workers, if they were able to get employment, most of them were, got jobs paying 50, 60, 70% of what they previously earned. Put yourself in that worker's position. How do you like it? 55 years of age, you got nothing in the bank, and you're making 50, 60% of what you used to make. You're optimistic about the future? Things going good? All these guys on TV, really? They're really talking to you? You don't believe a word of it, for good reason. Now, I'll tell you something else. That it was an experience that I will never forget. During the course of the campaign, Jane and I went to a county called McDowell County in southern West Virginia. And it used to be a coal mining area, and 50 years ago it was a fairly prosperous area, full employment, as the coal industry did well. Coal industry died off. The population went down in the county, I believe, from something like 100,000 to 20,000. Schools shut down. And right now it is one of the poorest counties in America. Now, what is interesting about McDowell County and why I went there for a town meeting, it was in a beautiful town meeting, just beautiful people. Reason I went there is McDowell County has a very unique and tragic distinction. It is one of many counties in this country, but maybe the worst, or one of the worst, where life expectancy is going down. All right. Now, there's a phenomenon, again, not talked about very much, but you should understand it, that throughout modern history, as you all know, everything being equal because of improvements in medicine and public health and so forth, people live longer. You will live longer than your parents on average. Your parents live longer than their parents on average, et cetera, et cetera. That's been the case in our country and around most of the world. Very few exceptions to that. And yet right now, for white working class Americans in many parts of our country, and we're talking about millions of people, their life expectancy is lower than their parents. I'll give you one example. It's an article in the New York Times made the point. Fairfax County is a wealthy county, as is Marin County. You're also mentioned there, I think. One of the wealthier counties in America, where life expectancy in Fairfax County for men is 82 years of age, which is equivalent to what goes on in Scandinavia. That's a long period. For women, life expectancy is 85 years of age. Men in Fairfax County, 82 years of age. Men in McDowell County die on average at the age of 64, 18 years younger than Fairfax County, which is 6 hours away by car. Women In Fairfax County, a wealthy suburb of Washington, D.C., women live to 85 years of age. Women in McDowell County live to 73 years of age, 12 years, they die 12 years earlier than the women in Fairfax. And this is not just McDowell County. All over this country, we're seeing this phenomenon. Why? What's going on? Well, the sociologists and the medical people who write it are not quite sure, but what they think is that the level of despair is so high in these communities, where if people are able to find a job, unemployment is very, very high in McDowell County, the jobs will pay $8, $9, $10 an hour, no future, their kids are going nowhere in a hurry. And what these folks are doing in alarming numbers are turning to heroin and opiates, they are turning to alcohol, and they are turning to suicide. So just that you will know this, in McDowell County, West Virginia, Donald Trump got 73% of the vote. All right? Now that's just one example, but that tells you something, that people in despair who are living in communities, crime is rampant, drugs are rampant, kids are going nowhere in a hurry, education system inadequate, they are feeling without hope, and they turn to somebody who I think lied to them, but they turned to him and he said, I will take on the establishment. I will do something for you. We went throughout the course of the campaign to Native American territory. We went to Pine Ridge in South Dakota, where the life expectancy of people on that reservation is the equivalent of what it is in Guatemala, a poor third world country. We saw on that Native American reservation youth suicide at horrific rates, alcoholism very high, unemployment rampant. We went to Baltimore, Maryland, and Baltimore is not unique, maybe it's a little bit worse than other large cities, where tens of thousands of people are addicted to heroin and there is no treatment available to them. We went on one evening, I was giving a speech in a low-income area, and we went for a walk through a neighborhood that was just totally desolate. Buildings boarded up, houses shuttered down. And in fact, the Secret Service was taking out these rather large packages, which had AK-47s, I think, because they were a little bit nervous about taking a walk in that neighborhood, which in the evening became a drug bazaar, and everybody knew it. In the evening, police leave, and the drugs are sold there. Tens of thousands of people in one city addicted to heroin. Now, what is my point in going over all of this? It is to tell you that there are a lot of people in our country who are hurting, and they are hurting very, very badly. That the political establishment is not hearing their pain. The financial and economic establishment could care less about their lives, and the media establishment is not dealing with the reality of their lives. And then comes along Mr. Trump. Now, how do we deal with it? I personally believe, as I said before, that Mr. Trump was not serious about addressing these issues, and the appointments that he's been making in the last week kind of bear that out. He told the American people that he was the only Republican candidate who would not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And then he appoints, or nominates, as his Secretary of Health and Human Services, a guy who has made it his life mission to privatize or cut Medicare and Medicaid. He has said that, I understand what terrible things Wall Street has done. We're going to take on the Wall Street establishment. And of course, he then nominated to be Secretary of Treasury, a guy whose life has been on Wall Street. And on it goes. So what we have got to do, it seems to me, is to create a strong grassroots movement where we bring people together to fight not only for social justice, not only for environmental justice, but for economic justice as well. But here is where it becomes difficult, because it is very easy for many Americans to say, I hate racism, unacceptable. Look at that person down there, racist, terrible. I hate homophobia, I hate sexism. But it is a little bit harder for people in the middle class or upper middle class to say, you know what, maybe we do have to deal with the greed of Wall Street. Maybe there is something a little bit strange when Wall Street banks, every single major bank, pays billions of dollars in settlement agreements with the federal government for illegal activity, but not one executive on Wall Street is prosecuted. Maybe that's a little bit weird. Maybe it's a little bit weird that the pharmaceutical industry charges us prices, depending on the drug, could be 2-3 times higher than they pay in the UK or Canada. Virtually every one of the drug companies also has had to pay substantial fines to the federal government for illegal behavior, but they have enough money to spend $131 million here in California to defeat a proposition that would lower the cost of drugs. Are we prepared to take on the pharmaceutical industry? Are we prepared to take on the greed of corporate America that will throw people out on the street tomorrow and move to China if they can make $5 more? Are we prepared to take on the fossil fuel industry, who believes that their short-term profits are more important than the future of our planet? So the reality is, in my view, that this country, both politically and economically, is moving toward an oligarchic form of society, where a small number of people, very, very wealthy and powerful people, control our economy and control our political life. That is the reality. And I know that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. They want to say, hey, I'm fighting for civil rights, I'm fighting for gay rights, and that's fine. And many of the people on Wall Street will agree with you. They're not racist, and they're not sexist, and their daughters have abortions, and their friends are black. Okay. But they do not want to be challenged with regard to their economic power. They want to continue to not to have to pay their fair share of taxes. They want to be able to have a few large institutions controlling what goes on in our economy. And one of the things I am trying to do, I was appointed a couple of weeks ago to be part of the Democratic leadership, for better or worse. And one of the things that I'm trying to do, and I'd love to have your thoughts on it, is to figure out a way as to how we can radically transform the Democratic Party from what I would call, and I don't mean it to be disparaging, it sounds disparaging, but from a party led by a liberal elite to a party led by working people and young people and people who really want to transform the society. Now, I think we've got some questions, and I just talked already a little bit too long, but if you read the book and you get bored in the middle, skip over to the last chapter. And the last chapter is called Corporate Media, A Threat to Our Democracy. And what that is about is it is very important. I remember when I was a kid, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, when you're 13 years of age and you're having an argument with somebody, and you say, to win the argument, you say, look, it was in the newspaper. I read it in the newspaper. By definition, if it was in the newspaper, it must be true. Well, I've come a long way from making that argument. All right. And what I now know is that today in America, you have 6 major media conglomerates, Comcast being the largest, and Time Warner and Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, or whatever it's called today. You got 6 major media conglomerates that control about 90% of the information that people get from television and radio and newspapers. 6. Okay. And what we found during the campaign, not that it was a new experience for me, but it was more personal during the campaign, is generally speaking, the more important the issue, the less coverage it got. So what you found in the campaign is that most of the media coverage was about Hillary Clinton and her life and her problems, and Mr. Trump and his life and his problems, but it didn't talk about your problems. Didn't talk about the problems of the American people. So it seems to me what politics is about is you're running for office and you say, look, these are the problems that I see and this is how I propose to solve that. According to studies out there, there's an organization called the Shorenstein Study for Media Campaigns at Harvard. They found that 90% of media coverage was political gossip, was polling, was fundraising, you know, dumb things the candidates say. Less than 10% actually was on the issues impacting the American people. And we've got to figure that out and how we change that, because we can't go forward as a nation unless we have an understanding of what's going on in the nation. And if the media does not communicate that reality, then we got a tough approach, we got a tough sledding ahead of us in order to resolve the problems if they're not being brought forward. Okay, that's my speech and I'm sticking to it. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, now. Okay, let's. Thank you. Let's take some of your questions.
I've never had so many questions for one of our leadership speakers. This is so exciting. I have a pack of questions for Good. You Good. About the Electoral College.
Good.
And how are we going to change that?
Good. It's a good question. Yes, I mean, I think as I mentioned earlier, there are, you know, generally speaking, we assume when we're in a group of people and we take a vote that the person who has or the idea that has the most votes wins. That is not the case in the United States of America, as you all know. Clinton won by 2.5 million votes and she's not being inaugurated. That's point one. There's another point that no one discussed, not discussed a whole lot, but I see as somebody who goes out campaigning, and did a lot of campaigning, is, you know, presidential candidates did not spend a lot of time in California. You know that? They didn't spend a lot of time in Vermont. Didn't spend a lot of time in Massachusetts. They didn't spend a lot of time in Wyoming or Alabama or South Carolina after the primaries. Why? Because everybody knows that California is a blue state. You're going to vote Democratic. Vermont, you're going to vote Democratic. Clinton won Vermont by, I don't know, 20, 30 points. Why campaign there? So campaigns then become focused on, you know, 15, 18 battleground states, Florida, Ohio, Michigan, many others who are in the, who might go one way or the other. It's not a good situation when the needs of California or Vermont or Republican states are not discussed as part of the presidential campaign. Those votes, those voters are taken for granted. So that worries me as well. But at the end of the day, clearly we have a system which is undemocratic and that it has to be changed. And I think it is an issue. I can't give you a definitive answer now, but it's something that has to change there. No doubts to my mind about that.
Well, please work on it. we're very happy you're in the leadership. I have several questions from teachers and people who are going to be teachers very soon saying, how do they inspire their students at this time? I wish every one of their students could have been in the audience tonight. But they're talking about the fact that their students are fearful. And what should they be saying? And how can they help their students to be effective? She's never giving it back.
This is what I think. And I've heard that question, time and time again. People are frightened, and teachers are nervous for their students. We have seen an outbreak of awful things done to Muslim kids, insults or bullying, et cetera, et cetera. Somehow, Trump unleashed the worst in many people. I think the answer, and probably the main point that I want to make to you this evening, is that the answer is to essentially fight back. Now, fighting back is an easy expression for me to make, and we have to be thoughtful about how we go forward. But what I would do if I were a teacher would be to remind the kids about the very, very rocky and difficult history of our country, okay? And again, as I mentioned earlier, and all of you know it, it was not so long ago, you know, that from an historical perspective, people were held in bondage in this country. And after the slaves were freed, they couldn't vote, and they were terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan and so forth and so on. Ugly, horrible, horrible things. But people did not give in to that, and they organized and they fought back. You know, you think about what happened with women who did not have the right to vote. They organized by the millions to say very clearly they would not be second-class citizens. You think about the gay community, the kinds of humiliation that people in the LGBT community went through, disguising their sexuality. And they fought back and succeeded in many ways. So I think what we have to look at the moment is that we are in a historical moment, we are in a difficult moment. But it is in a moment that we can address by organizing, by educating, and by fighting back effectively. Again, Mr. Trump's views do not reflect where a majority of the American people are. And our job, it is hard, easier talked about than done, is to mobilize people to say, sorry, Mr. Trump, we're not going back to bigotry. Sorry, Mr. Trump, we are going to protect undocumented people in this country. You're not going to break up families. Sorry, Mr. Trump, we will not tolerate sexism. Women have struggled too long and hard. Sorry, Mr. Trump, we are not going to become more dependent on fossil fuel. We're going to become less dependent on fossil fuel. So the challenge that we face, and this is something, you know, I think about, you know, all of my waking hours, and I think many of you are, and I don't have any simple answers. We're in Washington, we're working on it. I'm sure you're thinking about it as well. Okay, what do we do? What kind of leverage do we have? Republicans will control the White House, they'll control the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House. What leverage do we have? Well, in Washington, we have to determine the most effective way to fight back. But what I will tell you, it cannot just be an inside the Beltway struggle, it has to be outside the Beltway as well. You right here are in the largest state in the United States of America. It's something like what, California is the sixth largest economy in the world, or seventh largest, right? You have power here. New York State has power. Vermont has power. How do we use that power? How do we make an offer that they cannot refuse when we mobilize and make our demands very, very clear? Not easy stuff, but it's stuff that can be. We got to be smart, but we can do this. We can do this. Now, right now, the initial strategy that we have and what some of us are doing is simply reminding the American people of what Mr. Trump said during the campaign as opposed to what he is doing. All right? And we will remind the American people today and in the future of the fact that what he is doing now has no relationship to what he said he would do. Just one example. Mr. Trump talked a whole lot about our disastrous trade policies, and he said that if he was to be elected president, he would slap a 35% tariff on any company that left the United States and try to bring their products back into the United States. 35% tariff. Well, the first issue, the first opportunity that he had to deal with that issue, he did exactly the opposite. He went to United Technologies, which owns Carrier in Indiana that make furnaces and air conditioners, and instead of slapping a tariff, instead of saying to them that if they throw 2,100 workers out on the street, that they're not going to get that $6 billion they get from defense contracts, what he said, I'm going to really take you on, I'm sick and tired of it, and I'm going to give you a $7 million tax break. That was his punishment of that corporation, all right? $7 million in tax breaks paid for by the people of Indiana. Not what he said during the campaign, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got a lot of work to do, and you're going to have to, I can tell you without the slightest fear of hesitation here, is that in Washington, believe me, we don't have all the answers. We need people to be thinking about it. What is the most effective way to fight back? A lot of ways to do it, and let's think about it.
Yeah. Well, I have several questions on the subject of civil disobedience. And what is this the time for that?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously people will do as they want. Civil disobedience is one tool. Okay, it is one tool. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of tools in our arsenal. And this is, again, exactly what we are thinking about right now, and I personally have not thought it through. But give you an example. If there is a bank that is funding or putting money into the Dakota Access Pipeline, and if the American people said to that bank, I am withdrawing my funds from your bank and putting it into a local credit union, all right? If there is a corporation that is in one way or another doing things that we find is ugly, we can figure out ways to hurt that corporation financially. There are a lot of tools at our disposal, but mostly I think we've got to think it through and be smart and make Mr. Trump and his friends aware that we will not accept some of the ugly things that they have talked about.
That's fabulous. I have a very serious question here. Someone wants to know how you felt about Larry David portraying you on Saturday Night Live.
Well, I am Larry David. Okay? Bernie wanted to be with you tonight, but he's in Washington and he sent me, and I did a pretty good job, didn't I? There you go. You didn't know it. Larry David is a brilliant comedian, and it's a little bit creepy to see somebody play you better than you play yourself, so it's...
I think you play yourself very, very well. If we could just end on, you've given us such good advice. Several people have said, now you're in the leadership of the Democratic Party, and we're glad about that. And I'm sure you're going to be called obstructionist, and we would like to cheer you on in that. But what are the techniques for stopping this rollover of everything that America stands for?
I think it's a combination approach. My particular title now as part of the leadership is I'm head of the outreach effort, which means that I need your help and the help of many millions of other Americans. It means that we have to completely transform the Democratic Party into a grassroots party. There is a congressman from Minnesota, some of you may know, Keith Ellison, and Keith is running to be chair of the party. But it means that while in D.C. we have our job certainly cut out for us, and it's going to be very, very tough in terms of the nominations that Trump has made, et cetera, et cetera. We also have got to understand that we will not win this thing, it will come out well, unless there is an inside-outside strategy, and you are the outside, all right? So when millions of people stand together, we're going to be strong. But if Trump and his friends think they can run over us without opposition from grassroots America, if they are successful in doing that, then our hand is significantly weakened. So we need to work together. You strengthen us, and we will strengthen you. And again, this is not easy stuff, and I don't think anyone has a magical solution. We're moving into some politically uncharted territory. But what I honestly do believe is that if we are successful in bringing our people together, black and white and Latino and women and Asian American, Native American and gay and straight and everybody, we are the majority of the people. And when we stand together, we will, at the end of the day, win this thing. We will protect what has to be protected, and we will advance the ideas that have to be advanced, and we will resist those ideas that have to be defeated. But again, it cannot. Please do not look. And, you know, I can tell you a lot of my colleagues in the Senate are, you know, working really hard, and they're thinking hard on these issues. They're going to do their best. We're all going to do our best. But we need your help. This has to be an inside-outside approach, and we need to complement each other. So maybe let me conclude on this note. Despair today and never has been an effective option. It's not good enough to throw your hands up. It's not good enough to say I'm tired, and it's not good enough to say I'm disgusted. That's just not good enough, because what we are talking about is not just you. We're talking about your children, and we're talking about your grandchildren, and we're talking about the future of this planet. So we have a responsibility to rise to the occasion, as people have done throughout our history. This is not the only difficult moment in American history, you know? And people have risen up with great courage and done extraordinary things. And we have technology today, like the internet, that enables us to communicate with each other in a way that we have never been able to do before. And again, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, if millions of people stand together and say, sorry, Mr. Trump, you're not going to undermine American democracy. We're not going back to the days of bigotry. We are going to address the crisis of climate change. If millions of people are prepared to stand together, to move in that direction, we, in fact, will succeed. So it's an inside-outside strategy. Let's go forward together. Thank you all very much.
Bernie Sanders live on Penguin Radio, a worldwide broadcast from Dominican University of California. Glad you joined us tonight, everyone. It's been a real pleasure. Right here on Penguin Radio from Dominican University of California. Thanks for listening.